that Biden is cognitively up to the job of being president. I don't know how you battle back against that. Gretchen Whitmer, who is governor of Michigan, reportedly called Biden's campaign and said Michigan is no longer really in play for the president, which, you know, it's important to pan back and realize the reason this debate happened when it did was the Biden campaign was taking the risk that it would turn things around, especially they've been trailing in all the swing states, which, as we know from bitter experience, is, regardless of the popular vote, a ticket to losing the election. So they took this incredible risk to do this debate in which Biden performed in a way that really troubles everyone following our politics. And they're now saying it's a greater risk to change horses, and the risk has already been taken.
Chris Layman of The Nation, thanks so much. A very happy birthday to Isis Phillips, and we have a job opening. Director of Development, apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland. This morning, we will not be broadcasting More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule, and thank you for listening to KBOO. Portland.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. In the first half of the show, professor and author Mohamed Bamieh discusses the No State Solution, an idea rooted in Palestinian and regional history that speaks of legitimate liberation in the face of continued state-imposed oppression and colonialist violence. Mohamed also speaks of the origins and outgrowth of fundamentalism and the need to go beyond realism when reality has failed and continues to fail the people. In the second half of the program, I speak with journalist and author John Washington about his new book, The Case for Open Borders, and the historic, economic, political, and environmental reasons why and how open borders would not only be possible, but beneficial to all. John also highlights the contradictions and hypocrisies of borders, the inefficacy of militarized borders, and the very real effects of the recent Biden administration's move to essentially close the border. All this and more coming up now on Project Censored.
So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show. We're very glad right now to be joined by Professor Mohamed Bamieh, who's from the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh and is the author of Anarchy as Order, the History and Future of Civil Humanity. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'd like to start with some history to contextualize the idea of a no-state solution as something that's not at all alien, particularly for the region in which Palestine is. And what struck me when you were talking about it was actually the West African idea of Sankofa, which is the bringing forward of an idea from a people's own history. And I was wondering if you could just start by talking a little bit about how the no state solution is already woven in to the cultural and historical fabric of Palestinians and also the larger region.
The Palestinians, as you know, do not have a state of their own. And for a long time, of course, the emancipation of the Palestinians had been conceived or imagined in the form of a state that is independent. And that is fine, actually. I have no problem with that. And in fact, I have always supported the kind of Palestinian sovereignty, especially if it involves kind of freedom of occupation and ability to determine their future on their own. The fundamental problem is that for most of their histories, Palestinians actually have accommodated themselves to living without a state. And they have rebuilt their society in the diaspora after 1948, both in the refugee camps, as well as through organizations that they formed, as well as in civil society that they built across the world in the diaspora, all of that without a state. Now, Palestinians actually are not alone here, because if you look at the entire region of that we today call the Middle East, you also see that for most of the history of the region, people have actually also lived without a state, even though when they were governed formally by states, but most social life was actually kind of organized according to traditions that were voluntarily accepted, that were mutually understandable by the people. And that was also the case in the time of empires. The only exception was in the modern states when they were kind of imposed in the region, and after World War I in particular. And those states were, for the most part, imposed by colonial powers. They did not emerge out of organic process of state building from below, nor as an outcome of actually people's desire. And those states basically continue to exist until today. They were tolerated for a while in the post-independence period, because there was a hope that these states were of a modern nature. They would undertake developmental projects that were help people become prosperous and free and sovereign. And for a while, for a few decades, that kind of a promise was sort of believed in by many people in the region, until we hit the neoliberal era, beginning with the 1990s, in some places earlier, where in fact, states went back to what they had always done historically, which is to do little or nothing for most people. And essentially, social life continued basically to evolve in the Middle East for the most part outside of the realm of the state and independent of the state. And people take care of each other basically through, again, traditions of mutual help, conflict management, et cetera, that are known to them at the local level. So basically, from my point of view, and if you link up to the war that's going on in Gaza, as well as the war in Syria, the war in Libya, etc., right? All these wars that are raging in the region, it becomes clear that the modern state, the Israel included, are simply murder machines. They are there to serve themselves as states and their elites and no one else. And pretty much they go to war against people that they control, or against each other, as a matter of course, because of the way they are designed. They are designed essentially as competitors. And they see themselves, each other, as such. And they see their population also as a threat. I don't mean the population that is only the citizens of those states, but also the population that they control as a whole. So in the case of Israel, that would be including the Palestinian, basically as part of the population that lives also under the control of the state of Israel, and that is considered to be by the state of Israel to be an enemy of the state in the whole population. So when you look at this history, you realize that first, the state and society in the Middle East are two distinct things. They are often at odds with each other. Genocide, ethnic cleansing is part of the history we're talking about. And essentially, states are superfluous. I mean, we can live without them. We actually have done that without them. So it's not as though the idea of the no-state solution is something that is strange and far-fetched idea. It actually does represent the historical and the ongoing kind of reality of social organization in the region.
Yeah, thank you so much for that historical context. And I'm curious then, with the idea of a Palestinian state, do you feel that it's possible to create a Palestinian state that doesn't fall prey to these same issues that you just mentioned? Or is it impossible because a state as a colonialist and violent construct will always have those problems, even if it is created in order to push for the liberation of a Palestinian people?
I mean, if a Palestinian state comes into existence, I think that would be an improvement over the occupation. So it's not as though the no-state solution is the only solution that would improve the conditions that we have right now. A two-state solution would be an improvement over the occupation. A one-state solution in Israel-Palestine would also be an improvement of, over the two-state solution, because it would not require population movements, it would not require all kinds of unrealistic adjustments to the way people live, and it will be democratic and humane, ultimately. But neither the two-state solution nor the one-state solution seem to be practical from today's point of view or acceptable, because of not just because of the way the Israeli state itself is, has been constructed, but also because the kind of international kind of community is not willing actually to exert the kind of political capital and the kind of pressure that will be required to force either of those solutions. So I am actually not opposed to an independent Palestinian state, and I would be happy if that were to happen. I just don't see this to be a realistic. Ultimately, it is the Palestinians who have to decide, who have to be given an opportunity to decide about their future in a sovereign kind of way. So that's where I would leave it. And I'm basically putting the no-state solution ultimately as another solution to think about, which is actually in the long run, and this is not something that will happen tomorrow, of course, but in the long run, would be actually an adjustment to the continuous failures of the states, and we have experienced them.
I'm also curious, because you mentioned, of course, the myriad issues with statehood, but you also mentioned that the strengthening of the diaspora and the building of a Palestinian identity and collective selfhood, all done without a state. And very ironically, I have also felt the Jewish identity is similar, that we have a strong identity and a sense of self, not in spite of not having a state prior to 1948, but indeed because we do not. And now that there is one, in fact, I feel that the Jewish identity is ripping because of it. And you mentioned in a recent presentation that when we emancipate ourselves from this commitment to a national identity, that oppression and resistance to it has become our primary defining feature. This is what liberation looks like. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how statehood actually deflates and kind of denies a collective selfhood and a rich culture of multiple identities, and in many ways becomes kind of like a set of collective shackles.
I think a state, especially a state that is based on collective national identity as a stand-in for that national identity, rigidifies that identity. That makes it a lot more rigid than otherwise it would be. So if I say that I'm a Palestinian or an Arab or a Jew or whatever it is, but I don't have a state to actually represent kind of and stand in for that identity, kind of I have a lot more freedom basically with that, with where to deposit that identity. Of course, the formula is very different when you have a state that says, I represent you as a nation and you owe loyalty to me primarily, and all other potential loyalties you have to actually get rid of. And national conflicts emerged out of that kind of setup that we have constructed ourselves. So in the historical Middle East, you had large Jewish communities throughout the history of the Middle East, in Iran, in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, throughout North Africa, especially Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, all that, all of those places were full of Jewish communities that lived well with the Muslim majority and had their own rights, and they could live according to their own laws. None of those people went to Palestine, the Holy Land, all these times before 1948, even though there was nothing to prevent them from doing so. So if you look at the history of coexistence of various types of communities throughout the region, you notice that actually the thing that made these relationships kind of warlike was in fact that each nation had to create its own exclusive community, which meant ethnic cleansing. You have to move people out of the territory you conclude, or you have to take rights away from them. And of course, that causes unhappiness, problems of security that come out of that, and war. All of that has happened. So I think actually that I don't have actually a problem with people having any specific identity and be attached to it in particular, so long as there is no power structure that actually deposits that identity into a violent system and put it in contrast and against other types of identities in the same region. This is what we have right now And this is, in fact, the fundamental factor behind the genocide that is happening in Gaza right now.
While you were talking, I was thinking a little bit about the Umayyad Caliphate in Al-Andalus in southern Spain, which was technically under the yoke of the Abbasids, who were then governing from Baghdad. But in reality, they had their own form of governance, their own laws, and Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived together without a problem, basically until Ferdinand and Isabella came to power, and then what we know as the Inquisition and everything kicked off. So when it was under the Muslim control, technically, these people were able to live together without issues. And then, as you said, that you had to create the other and you had to create those distinctions.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with professor and author Mohamed Bamieh.
I want to dig into something that you've also discussed, and I really liked the way that you framed this, what you call organic anarchism, an anarchist method of rebellion that seems to be ingrained in familiar social traditions. Could you talk a little bit about this organic anarchism and how this kind of moves itself towards a no-state solution and how this has shown itself to work within the Palestinian communities?
When I began to think about what became my book, Anarchy as Order, actually, I sketched there are two types of anarchy that I was concerned. One was the self-conscious anarchism, the anarchist movement that begins with the Enlightenment thought, and becomes an organized movement in Europe as of the mid-19th century and continues to be with us until today, ultimately self-conscious anarchism. But I thought actually there is a larger social, global history of anarchism that has little to do with the self-conscious anarchism, and namely that is the large cluster of autonomous, self-organized societies that live underneath the state, but they have their own systems. And this is something that, that my book actually tried to actually document historically. And not only in terms of social organizations historically, before colonialism in particular, but also in terms of political philosophies that you see in the Muslim world, in the Hindu world, also in medieval Europe. Or you even see it in Machiavelli as well, by the way, where the fundamental point is that state and society have nothing to do with each other, that the state has its own logic, its own kind of way of thinking, its own systems of management and rule, and society has its own kind of ways of organizing itself. That is something that you see across all these political philosophies across the world as well. That reflect, in fact, the awareness of historical political philosophers across various civilizations of the fact that society has its own kind of organizational model and so state has its own mind, to speak right. And that is where the idea of organic anarchism comes in. So, and the anarchism that is done by millions of people who actually have not read any books about anarchism, they may not even know what the term means, but practically their life is kind of organized around mutual help, basically, solidarity, non-conflict management solutions. Typically, they have very little in the way of prisons, for example, of coercive apparatuses. These are used by the state, but not really by society. And you see it in 2011 and 2019 in the Arab world, in the Arab uprising movements, where, in fact, you have revolutions of a new kind that had no leadership, that had no organization behind them, and that seemed to nonetheless be able to mobilize millions of people. And that, in my analysis, of course, of those revolutions, that style of doing revolution comes out of already known way of mobilizing and spontaneous action and so on. And that was, relatively speaking, a new way that was reawakened a familiar social traditions and mobilized them in a revolutionary direction. So we haven't had that actually before, where kind of this organic anarchism that I'm talking about actually becoming incendiary material for revolution. That is relatively new. And that is the era I think we are going, because if you look at other protest movements around the world since 2011, you also see similar features. They may be smaller in other parts of the world, but they have the same features. Loose network of activists, not centrally organized, the spontaneity being an art of movement, this being in the name of the people as a whole, or the 99% or something like that, but not in the name of something like the working class or any specific group. So organic anarchism is part of social traditions everywhere, historically speaking. And right now, it's being reawakened, I think, right? Again, it is not called anarchism, right, by the people who actually do it, but it does have a clearly a kind of a lot of similarity to the philosophical kind of self-conscious anarchist kind of tradition, let's say. And one more point about this is that when we talk about organic anarchism, I think it is in the minds of most people whom I describe as such, it is mixed in with other elements. So it's not as though this is actually pure ideology. For example, you have lots of people in Egypt, for example, or Tunisia, who actually do rely on each other, live a pattern of everyday life that may be considered to be organically anarchist. But also, at other points, they may have no problem with something that we call enlightened despotism, for example, of someone who comes in and promises to help solve problems, is perhaps given a chance to do so. So we're talking about, when we talk about organic anarchism, we're also talking about a social ideology that is also mixed with other ideology in the same mind. Over time, of course, the difference between these way different types of thinking about governing a social life become more and more kind of distinct from each other with experience.
Thank you for that. And I'm curious how you would see, for instance, the intifadas. Would you see those as an example of organic anarchism?
Exactly. Yeah. I talked about especially the first intifada as a good example of that. And it is actually the first, especially in the larger Middle Eastern history of an event like that. We had, of course, the Palestinian Resistance Movement that was organized and happened before in the 1987 when the intifada broke. But the first intifada had the same characteristic, namely it has a spontaneous character, it was collective. It did not have, at the beginning at least, did not really have leadership behind it. And it happened at a time when the PLO was very weak, sitting in exile in Tunisia, had very little effect on anything that was happening in Palestine. The Arab world had forgotten about Palestine at that point as well. It was busy with the Iran-Iraq war. That was the main concern for all Arab governments at that point. So the Palestinians felt abandoned completely at that point and weak. And precisely at that point, you have this organic anarchist social capital exploding in the form of a revolution that we call the Intifada. And so the advantage, I think, of this organic anarchist culture is that it provides a way for people to mobilize with each other using social traditions and at times when their social, when their organizations are weak, when their leadership is absent or irrelevant, to speak of. But their grievances are still there. So actually they have to do something and they do it with the help of whatever cultural resources that happen to be available to them. And that has happened earlier, of course, in Palestinian history, not in the form of intifada, but in other in terms of actually maintaining kind of Palestinian society alive and well connected.
Thank you. And I want to dig into something also that you've spoken about in a previous presentation, which is the issue of religiosity. And you'd spoken before about what we call here fundamentalist Islam being an outgrowth of colonialist violence, basically. That it's not something that comes from these organic shared social and communal traditions. And in that sense, to me, it felt a bit like how we talk about how the U.S. is responsible basically for the creation of ISIS, or the U.S.'s strong ties to Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, not least of all having Osama bin Laden on the CIA's payroll. Could you talk a little bit more about how these fundamentalist movements are actually outgrowths of that colonialist violence?
They are. There are different origins of fundamentalisms. So it's not actually all the same thing. So part of it has to do with the kind of fundamentalism that you see first established in places like Saudi Arabia. And that fundamentalism was part of the state building project in a place like Saudi Arabia, where it had to be imposed by force. That is, fundamentalism, the Wahhabism, the Wahhabi version of it, always relied on a state force to impose it on the population. It was not something that people believed in voluntarily. Of course, every time you see a variety of religion that requires force to be imposed, you know that it is weakly rooted in society. Otherwise, force will not be necessary. And later on, you have another variety of fundamentalism that also comes from the ground up. That is not necessarily related to state, but actually often is an opposition to the state. And that is something that you see when you have social problems or political problems that persist and no one is resolving them. For example, Hamas. In 1948, there was no Hamas. In 1967, there was no Hamas either. It took 40 years of basically constant repression of the Palestinians for something like Hamas to emerge and say, okay, well, these secular forces have not resolved your problem. So here is one force within your tradition that could help you. So fundamentalism, or what we call fundamentalism, actually is not a natural outgrowth of any, especially when it comes from below. It is not really something that simply burst out without lots of social problems that no one else have been able to actually deal with. And elsewhere in the region, you see that as well. So basically, the post-independence period in most Arab countries, there was actually no fundamentalism anywhere. The post-colonial elite, both political and cultural elite, were entirely secular up until the late 70s. In 1979, you have the Iranian Revolution, which is impressive to a lot of people because that is the first time where Islam actually is mobilized in a revolutionary direction. A lot of people who before that were secular and had no connection to religion begin to think that maybe religion actually is our way out of this mess. For example, the founder of the Islamic Jihad in Gaza in 1979 actually was a Nasserite pan-Arabist nationalist. He had no connection to Islam at all. But then he saw Khomeini being successful in Iran and said, well, this could work. So basically, fundamentalism often emerges out of this pragmatic kind of search for solutions and an experimental way, basically, right? Until, of course, the fundamentalist solution itself fails, in which case it gives heart to another type of ideology. So long as the problem is there and requires to be solved by someone who can promise to have an effective way of doing it. And there is an older kind of version of everything that I just described. That is, in the early phases of colonialism in the Middle East, there was a debate in Arab intellectual circles about what caused our, say, as they call it, backwardness. So the secular nationalists would say it was colonialism. Colonialism is the problem, and we had to fight colonialism. Those who were more religious argued, no, colonialism came to us because we were weak, and we became weak because we had abandoned our tradition, and therefore we have to go back and strengthen ourselves through our traditions. And that debate continues until today. So in a way, it is not as though fundamentalism in either case was the only kind of answer there, but it is one of the range of possible kind of answers to persisting problems.
What you're describing sounds a lot like what we see here in the U.S., the Christian fundamentalists who say we have to go back to this past. Mm-hmm. We have these problems because we've strayed from the path. It seems like it's the same script. So wrapping up here, Mohammed, I'd really like to talk to you about your perspectives on reality and realism, because I found that to be a really fascinating and important argument that you made, that when realism as a perspective is useless and when reality is unacceptable, you have to go beyond. And I'm curious here also about the conversation about utopia, because utopia literally translates to no place. And I've often felt that aiming for a utopia is largely a pointless endeavor, but rather to imagine worlds that not only can exist, but perhaps already do and have existed. So could you talk a little bit about that argument that you've made about realism and reality and going beyond?
Yeah, sure. I think that's an important point, because the problem that we have in Israel-Palestine is because the realist solutions are not working, and they cannot work. And there's a lot of history behind why they cannot work. Now, that means actually this reality that's producing genocide today is unacceptable. And that the realists, meaning that the diplomats, those who think within the parameters of the states, actually have become useless people. So that means that we have to actually look beyond reality, and we have to look at historical example where we have all kinds of revolutions, the Bolsheviks, Khomeini, etc., the Palestinian resistance movement itself, all of which were kind of undertaken by unrealistic people. Why do the weak attack the strong? Because that happens, of course, but it is also unrealistic from the point of view of those who highlight realism. But that is how revolutions happen, by people who actually do not know whether they have a chance of success or not, but they have to act. And much of grand historical change has happened that way, not by realistic people, but by people who had no connection to realism at all and rejected it. That does not mean that the result is always great. In fact, a lot of damage, of course, could result from actually ignoring realism. But from a sociological point of view, I think what matters more is not the result, but analyzing the situation and to say, actually, in our history, and the global revolution history in particular, the lack of realism has been an important kind of motivating factor, more so where will and vitality, basically, rejecting reality altogether because it is not working. That seemed to be a lot more important than having actually a clear plan and realistic mindset. And that's where we are now, because ultimately, if you look at the fact at what is happening in Gaza right now, we see a reality that is completely unacceptable. And we see actually that people who are trying to think of a realistic way to solve that problem are themselves kind of unable to do anything about it. So that is an opportunity, I think, to think beyond the limits of what exists, because what exists is unhelpful, basically, and not only unhelpful, but is also genocidal and criminal. And so that is where, and part, of course, of the way of thinking beyond reality and realism is the no-state solution, in my mind. Because that is really the kind of a time when one has to think about something beyond what is possible. Now, I do not want to present any of this as utopia, because I don't think actually utopia is something that we can arrive at. But we actually need to understand, I think, the captivating power of the utopian imagination. People go to revolutions en masse, 2019, which are events that I have observed firsthand, because they have a utopian imagination. And that is, they don't have a plan. They don't know if the revolution is going to work. But they go into the revolution, and within that revolution, they have a utopian experience that it is actually the kind of camaraderie and solidarity and friendliness that they experience the revolution, perhaps is the way future society is going to be after the revolution. That is what moves people. So it's not as though what I'm describing here is going to lead to a utopia. I think it would lead to a much better reality than we have right now, but it is not utopia. On the other hand, people who actually do reject reality and realism do often actually have this utopian impulse that keeps them going. And that is important enough for the revolutionary act.
So it's kind of like a utopian hope that's the fuel. Well, Mohamed Bamiyan, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and lay out all of this important context and all of these ideas. Again, Mohamed Bamiyan is from the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, and is the author of Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civil Humanity. Mohamed, thank you again so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. In the next segment, I'll speak with journalist and author John Washington about the case for open borders. But first, a brief musical break. Please stay with us. It was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You could pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means. APAC, Koofy, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. Super band, TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show. We're very glad to welcome to the show John Washington. who is a staff writer at Arizona Luminaria, a community-focused media outlet where he writes about the border, climate change, democracy, and more. He's written for the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, the Atlantic, the Washington Post, The Nation, and others. And his most recent book is called The Case for Open Borders. And you can find his other writings at Substack at johnwashington.substack.com. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I must congratulate you on not just a really powerful book in terms of the research, but a really beautifully written book. I feel like sometimes, so often, books that are so stacked with information can feel like you're reading Encyclopedia Britannica, but that was not the case at all. And I want to start with the framing here and the conversation of borders being synonymous, not only with violence, which we'll talk about in a bit, but also a violent history and present of colonialism and of nation state building, and therefore with the inherent hypocrisy and arbitrariness in aid of that colonial nation state. And for instance, many tend to think of borders as like these stagnant things that never move. And yet, as you write in the book, quote, "The border can be moved to ensure its immovability. It can be violated to prove its inviolability. It can be crossed to prove its uncrossability," end quote. And I think that that's just such a beautiful way of succinctly highlighting the contradictions of the border. Could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by what you wrote there?
I think there's a number of inherent paradoxes in bordering. We could list a bunch. One is that the very idea of closing down a border or criminalizing border crossing, what it does is creates a crime. That crime would not exist if we didn't look at human mobility the way that we do, when we know that it's not only inherent to our species, but it is a necessary means of survival. A couple other paradoxes include the fact that people know that we need migrants. Let's stick with the United States right now. There are really serious shortages in various sectors of the economy. And we know that if we actually do what now more and more politicians are saying, deport all of the undocumented people, close down the border, that it would tank the economy. It would be terrible. We know that. And yet we play this bizarre game where especially politicians who are anti-immigrant or immigrant restrictionists are speaking out of both sides of their mouth, who say, we need to shut down the border, but we need people to get across. You actually can't have it both ways. And yet the border is having it both ways. Because, you know, what the border actually does is, you know, speaking in real terms, it kills people along the line who are trying to cross it, or makes their lives much more difficult, makes their crossings much more dangerous, makes them suffer more as they try to cross it. And it immiserates people on both sides of the line. Talk to an economist. The border doesn't protect one side from the other. What it does is it creates the gaps that then push people from one side to the other. You know, the paradoxes just accelerate from here. So when I was writing that specific line, I think I was referencing, if I remember right, I was referencing that the border is malleable. We decide to enforce the border in different ways at different times. We actually position the border in different places at different times. You know, for the last number of years, number of decades now, we have all grown accustomed to the United States, the border sort of following the like the logo map of the United States. But you start peeling back decades before that, and the border line was changing dramatically. And now, too, not in strictly like juridical terms, but the border is still very much moving. We are co-opting Mexico, other countries, Central America, to enforce what is essentially our border further and further south. This is happening in the EU, too. No longer is it just the Mediterranean coastline or, you know, the Greek-Turkish border or the Eastern European borders, but you see that Frontex and even individual European countries are pushing the border down by co-opting Libyan Coast Guard, then Nigerian and Nigerian Border Patrol, basically agents. And so you see that the border does actually move. And one more really concrete example here that is just, I think, so illuminating is I spoke or wrote at length, relative length in the book about Australia. They actually decided to cut off a island that was part of the national territory of Australia because asylum seekers were able to access it more easily. It was 1,000 miles off the coast of Australia. Through the logic of colonialists, they somehow claimed it was their own, and migrants started showing up there, and they're like, well, we have to legally process these people. Now what do we do? How do we deal with it? Maybe we should just pretend that that's no longer Australian territory. How convenient. And so what they were doing by changing the actual border line is trying to protect the border. So paradoxes abound about bordering.
That example about Australia in the book is just so, you're proving the point here. And I want to get to the kind of like the psychology of this, because you go into this as well, that, quote, a border wall or a border gate reveals a nationalist fiction based on a mythologically constructed present and an often apocryphal past more than any geographic, cultural, or political truth, end quote. So really, it seems that the borders, while a very physical aspect, it's really a psychological aspect. And so when we're talking about the case for open borders, it seems that you first have to break down a mythology, which is certainly not an easy task, I would say. Could you talk a little bit more about the psychology and the mythology of borders that we really latch onto?
Yeah. You know, I think a easy way of understanding the problem here is a quip that often gets used to defend borders. People say something like, well, you lock your doors at night, so wouldn't you want to close your border to protect people from coming in? Because this is our little private sacred space, whatever. This is our home. And if people come in, it could be a problem for you. So we should lock our doors. It's like, okay, that analogy breaks down for a lot of reasons. One, I actually addressed this in the books, like comparing a nation state to a individual private home doesn't make any sense. But there's one other, I think, really crucial way that this analogy falls apart, and is that, okay, probably if you're a homeowner, you paid for your home or are still paying for your home. You took out, you know, a mortgage, you're paying the bank, or maybe you were able to buy it straight up. That was a legal process involving two consenting parties. That is not the way that borders are drawn. That is not the way that nation states, modern nation states, have been created. So if we were to actually analogize how nation states were created into a home, it would be like these people burst into this house, evicted the people who were living there, tore it to pieces, completely remodeled it, and then put new locks on the door. So just ethically, or from a moral perspective, or from a legal perspective, do you have the right to live in that home and block people from coming in? I don't think you do. And that is the way that borders actually work. To break down the mythology, this is, you know, obviously a pretty simplistic analogy there, but think about how borders were created. You know, the United States-Mexico border, people came in and there was genocide that took place and was how now the United States is able to claim these territories for their own. They slaughtered and tried to put an end to multiple cultures. Then they, at gunpoint, stole land from another nation, Mexico, and now erected these borders. So harking back to this idea of this pristine recent past is just blinding yourselves to a really bloody history. And then you look into different parts of the world and you notice that, well, in Africa, I think, I can't remember the number right now, it's like 80% of the African countries have straight lines as borders. And it's like, you think that actually complied or represented the divisions of cultures? No, it didn't. Because those cultures and many indigenous cultures throughout the world did not have exclusive lines of control. I'm not saying that it was a heyday. I mean, it's not like there was no war and no incursions and no attempts at territorial conquest, but there was something very different along the edges of control. And it wasn't exclusive militarized bordering, which cements some of those problematic pasts. And so we need to be advancing beyond this idea of supposed ethnic exclusionary communities, which are not realistic and never really have been, and thinking about actually a way that people can move about the world or whatever part of it in a safe, orderly, humane way.
While you were talking, I was thinking about the intentionality here. And I recently read following Biden's not very shocking, but disgusting announcement about essentially closing the borders to asylum seekers. There was an article in The Intercept that covered how this is like a very Democrat thing to do. And in 1994, at the very same time that then President Bill Clinton signed NAFTA, the Army Corps of Engineers began to fence the US-Mexico border. And so it's like there's this understanding that, hey, we're going to do this thing that is going to be very, very bad for the people that are involved in it. And they're going to try to move because of it. And we have to make sure that they can't. And so there's this very clear understanding how those borders work from the people who write these policies at times. And I wanted to get into a little bit about migrants specifically, because what you also highlight in the book is how much of a toss-up this is in terms of like who's deemed unworthy or worthy, and at times how that's often based on the need for labor or the fear that jobs will be, you know, swept up by the invading hordes. And something that I think is such a perfect example of this hypocrisy and the arbitrariness is what you write about in the book about the policy change with regards to Chinese migration. Could you talk a little bit more about that 180 and how this selective othering also speaks to that nonsensical nature of these borders?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing up the Intercept article. That's by Natasha Leonard, a friend of mine and a great writer, and people should go check it out. Yeah, Biden's executive order, which is a moral disaster and will result in two really clear things if it continues in effect. I mean, there's a good chance that it's going to be enjoined by the courts, but it's going to result in more people taking more dangerous journeys because they do not have access to safe or legal migration. And it's going to result in family separations. And this is a thing that I think has gotten a little bit less attention, but it's something I've been concentrating on the past year, ongoing reporting about family separations. And there is an exception in the new executive order that unaccompanied minors may still cross, but only them. And there are, of course, still migrants who are young or under 18 who are migrating all the way from their home countries to the United States alone. But most young kids are traveling with their parents or their family members. And I have seen this firsthand where because of these policies, because of the extremely long waits, leaves people in incredibly precarious places in northern Mexico, family members or parents decide to send their kids on alone. This is a coerced family separation. I witnessed last year a mom say goodbye to her two teenage children in northern Mexico. They had been waiting for months. They hadn't gone to school in over a year. She was scared that because of the security situation there. She saw no hope in actually being able to do it legally. Her home was impossible to live in. And she said goodbye to her two children and they crossed the border alone. We're going to see more of this under this new executive order.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, especially as a mother. I have a hard time with that. But I think it's so important that you highlight that, because I think that sometimes gets lost in just the stats, like people talking about like, well, it can't pass 1,500. We get lost in the numbers game and forget that this is somebody being torn apart from their children.
Biden put out a tweet a day or so after the executive order. He was sort of trying to stand on principle, saying, I'm doing this supposedly to make the border more secure, or it's not anti-humane or whatever, inhumane. And he said, here's what I won't do. I will not separate children. Again, we are dealing with one of these just paradox isn't the right word, just hypocrisies of the way that bordering happens. Is you can say that, but you're also not stupid. People can argue otherwise, but you have teams, legions of policymakers who understand how this works. They know that people are going to be separated from their children. They absolutely know.
I think that that also, the inhumanity there shows that part of this bordering project is to dictate who is a human, who is not, like necropolitics, who deserves to live and who do we not care about. And as you pointed out in your book, this has been just like a whack-a-mole policy since the advent of the United States. Jews, Irish, Italians, people from Central and South America, Chinese, it's just so arbitrary and indeed fluid, a bit like borders.
Yeah. So to go back to your question about Chinese migration in the 19th century, So there was the Burlingame Treaty, which I think was 1868. Interesting era. A lot was happening in the United States at the time. And there was also a lot of fallout from a brutal civil war and manumission. There was a huge building boom and construction boom and the railroad, construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. And Chinese laborers were able to get to the West Coast of the United States in many regards more easily than people migrating slowly across land from the East Coast. And they were welcome because they were ready workers. The Burlingame Treaty, looking at the actual language, is amazing. The mutual and beneficial exchange of labor, the friendship between our two nations, and the celebration of open migration. Wow. This was like an open borders celebration. And a few years later, early 1880s, there was the Page Act, which was like the first federal immigration policy that was implemented. And it was specifically targeting Chinese women. There's like a slate of anti-Chinese, specifically anti-Chinese legislation, which are collectively known as the Chinese Exclusion Acts. And this was the first time that the federal government was taking from the states the power to enforce immigration. Before that, it was the states' rights. Again, thinking of the era, what did that imply? And this comes out of a brutal history. So it's not just the contention between states and federal rights, but the reason that the federal government before that had allowed the states to enforce immigration. And they did. It was not complete open borders world that we were living in, or open borders country that we were living in. It was because, in large part, the same reason that states wanted to have their own rights. And because when an enslaved person was leaving a slave state, they wanted to be able to go and get that person. And so we saw the rise of basically proto-immigration laws with the Fugitive Slave Acts. But the states were worried that if the federal government had full control over immigration authority, they would not enforce some of those laws. But finally, when we had finished the Transcontinental Railroad, put in the Golden Spike, and they're like, you know what, actually, we don't need so many Chinese laborers. There's also a number of, again, with fallout of the war, there's a number of economic depressions at the time. And it's like, you know what, maybe we need to stop letting in more Chinese people. And they were excluded until the 1940s. So Chinese exclusion laws were officially on the books until the 1940s. And then a number of really abysmal Supreme Court decisions cemented this authority of the federal government to enforce immigration law. This is pertinent right now. The federal government is not on one side, and Texas and now probably Arizona are not on the other side. They are on the same side. They are vying for control to enforce and expel and block migrants. There is not one party who's in favor of migrants here. They're both trying to keep them out and push them out. And the federal government is claiming the authority to do so based on those Supreme Court decisions allowing explicitly racist anti-Chinese policies to go into effect. The Biden administration is citing those cases right now. So they're not our saviors of Texas. They're trying to do it themselves.
And with that, I want to shift to one of the arguments that you make, because in the book, there are powerful arguments for opening borders based on history and economics, which you touched on a bit. But I really appreciate that you bring into the spotlight the environmental argument and make a powerful case that rather than a militarized border saving us from the fallout of climate catastrophe, it actually blinds us to it and worsens it. Could you talk a little bit more about that aspect?
Yeah, so this is my favorite stat, as in my least favorite, that in a very recent five-year period, the United States spent 11 times more on border enforcement than it did on climate change mitigation. Knowing that vast swaths of the globe are being rendered uninhabitable, you aren't going to fix that by erecting a higher wall. And here's one other point that is not exactly relevant to the environmental argument, is that one of the things I looked at in the book too is that we have decades upon decades of evidence showing that walls don't work, that people get through them, that immigration enforcement, the most draconian immigration enforcement, doesn't work. Doesn't work in the United States, doesn't work in Europe. It changes the way people migrate a little bit. It makes it harder, it makes it more deadly, but it doesn't stop people. So your wall isn't going to stop the people who are fleeing climate change from coming. So you can either address the underlying cause, or you can not stop them from coming, but spend billions of dollars trying. Again, people know this. This isn't like a revelation that I am exposing. A quarter billion, a half a billion in the next decade or so, we're looking at orders of magnitude more people who can't live where they're living. And they're going to move, absolutely. And so we need to think about how to respond to them. And as I just said, trying to wall them off doesn't work.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And as you write in the book, to try to stop humans from moving is to try to stop humans from being humans. And I think, kind of wrapping up here, I know that we've talked about some history and we've talked about some present, but I think it's important to highlight like how recent some of this is. As you point out in the book, before the 1990s, there was almost no physical infrastructure along the US-Mexico borderline. You know, ICE was founded in 2003. And you also write that there are more closed borders today than at any other time in human history. And so wrapping up here, John, I know that it looks bleak, I have to say. Things have gotten worse very quickly, domestically and globally. And there's that case for open borders, which is, to me, it's kind of like this. Earlier, we spoke with Mohamed Bamier about the no state solution in Palestine. And one of the things he says is that when reality and realism are unacceptable, you have to go beyond. And it feels to me like the case for open borders is that the reality of this situation is so unacceptable. We must think of something beyond. And also in the here and now, what kind of ways can we act, should we act, to make things better in the face of these literal and figurative walls and blockades that we face?
Good, daunting question. You know, I think the history is important. And I think actually the history is one of the necessary ingredients for moving forward towards a more just future. You pointed out some really key moments that somehow we forget. We are a society of amnesiacs. You know, I think I'm interested in this idea that we need to imagine a better future. We need to like really sort of stretch our minds a little bit. As a reporter here, as a, like a local reporter, one way that I think a necessary first step is actually something like the opposite of imagination. We have so much disinformation, misinformation, and refusal to hear information right now. You know, there are so many people, especially on the right, who are claiming right now that we have open borders. There is such a huge disparity in the basic understanding of the reality right now that I think we need to close that gap before we're able to even start talking about solutions. And I think that one of the key ingredients is just understanding our basic reality right now.
John, thank you so much for giving so much context. Again, folks can check out the book, which is called The Case for Open Borders. And John's other writings are at johnwashington.substack.com. John, thank you again so much for taking the time to sit down.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S., from Maui to New York, and you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed. And be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Perpetuated by
about criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies like an ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, confine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, if you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music